tonight on Arena. News of the World, music and private chat are the movies up for review. And Catherine Milligan talks to us about her new book, Painting Dublin, 1886 to 1949. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And to films first this evening, we delve into the pick of this week's digital features. Netflix brings us News of the World, which is not set in a tabloid newsroom, but rather in the American Wild West of the 1870s. Music is the debut feature film from the musician Sia. It has been mired in controversy for its depiction of autism. And we also have Private Chat, a film about isolation, the internet and sex. I'm joined by Justin McGregor and Sarah Taff Maguire. And we'll start off with News of the World. Justin, we're, as I said, we're not anywhere near the newspaper of the same world. We're in Texas of the 1870s. Tom Hanks is involved in news reading. Just explain the setup here.
Yeah, no, the setup is that he's it's at just after the Civil War, and he was a captain for the Confederate Army, and he drives around on a cart or rides around on his horse from town to town, and he has a collection of newspapers from Houston, from New York, from Europe, and he reads the stories like as a kind of entertaining, almost like a, you know, like a live news broadcast. And he goes around and the halls fill up, but a lot of people, of course, at that time couldn't read, so that was part of it, but it's also the social side of it. So he reads them these stories, he picks a selection that he thinks they'll enjoy, and this is his livelihood.
And that's kind of the setup, Sarah, but really it's his happening upon a young girl that sets the film off in a new direction. Who is she and what's her role?
So this is a little girl called Johanna, played by Helena Zengel. He finds her in an upturned wagon and she's been taken from a Native American tribe who actually had taken her when they killed her family. They had raised her. So she's essentially been raised as an Indigenous child, wearing Indigenous clothing, speaking Indigenous language. But of course, she's being returned to her original family. I believe it's her aunt she's being returned to in Dallas. So When Tom Hanks's character Captain Kidd happens across her, he takes it upon himself to bring her back to Dallas. As it turns out, the Indian agent, the government official who would be tasked with delivering her, is not going to be in town for the next 3 months. So he's saddled with this girl, and the story is essentially them traveling across this lawless and beautiful terrain to deliver her and their burgeoning relationship.
Justin, the period here is in American history is referred to as the Reconstruction period. What is that, and how vital is it to the story that's been told?
No, it's very vital because, of course, the Southern states surrendered, and the Texas Territory, as it was, had surrendered, and there was a lot of bitterness over the defeat. So the blue coats, you know, the northern blues, are seen very much as an occupying force. And of course, Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd has a lot of respect because he's not only captain in the Confederacy, but he had fought in three wars, actually, not just the Civil War, but the two other wars before that. So it's very important that there's this underlying bitterness. And for instance, he always reads a federal story, you know, from the federal government, and the crowd always boos, you know, as he does it, because they want to hear local news. They don't really want to hear about, you know, the occupier, as it were.
Oh, but I think we lost Justin briefly there. We'll come back to him. Sarah, I suppose essentially it becomes a kind of a buddy movie between the young girl and the Tom Hanks character.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just the two of them on the road. Poor little Helena, poor little Johanna. She doesn't know what's going on. She's been tossed from place to place. As I mentioned, her original family had died, and now she's been raised by this tribe who she escapes to try and reconnect with. And she, you know, she's had forced to wear clothing of the day, and the two of them begin to teach each other things about their world, and are forced to fight their way across the terrain. So it's really the story of their growing relationship,
And as you say, they begin to teach each other things, including teaching each other their various languages. Tom Hanks here and Johanna, played by Helena Zengel. Here's a little scene where they're teaching each other words.
See that bird? Bird.
Bird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Good.
Gutto?
Gutto.
The bird is Gutto?
Gutto.
Gutto.
Ongo pee.
Buffalo. Since you're so smart. Prickly pear cactus. There, cactus, and there's juniper out there. And there's some sage.
Sage, yeah.
Sage, yeah.
Sage,
yeah. Sage, yeah. That's right, it smells good.
Good.
Yeah. So, what else can you teach me?
Oh, lots, I would think. That's Helena Zengel as the power character of Joanna and Tom Hanks as Captain Jefferson Kyle Kidd. It is all ultimately just about the chemistry between those two characters. Is there enough in that to carry it? And does the story bring us along?
Yeah, I mean, it does unfold, you know, at a very moderate pace. Well, you can kind of hear it there, that the wheels going round and that pace of the wagon. The film kind of moves at that pace, I think, very, very deliberately. And there are some sort of action pieces in between, but even those are quite subdued, given it's Paul Greengrass who did the Bourne movies, which are frenetic. It does just sort of unfold in a very lovely way, and they earn that relationship, you know, I think, between Joanna and Captain Kidd. They really earn it. They let it unfold in a way that it is really, really believable, and we kind of hope they're going to stay together, you know, beyond, you know, this drop-off that they're really heading towards. So I think in that it's very lovely, but it does just kind of unfold, you know, like a story being read to you, really.
Right. What about the Tom Hanks character here? A lot's been made. I've made a lot out of it myself, the fact that this is his first Western. But are we getting anything from Tom Hanks that we haven't seen before? Not that that's necessarily a problem, one would have to say, Sarah.
Well, essentially, I think how I phrase it is that Tom Hanks plays Tom Hanks in a film starring Tom Hanks. So he's sort of like a classic Hanks character. He's nicer than most, but fairly neutral. You know, he's not the absolute good guy on the side of the Native Americans who are going through, you know, one of the worst parts of the genocide against them. He's not originally extraordinarily nice to Joanna, you know, saying, oh, I must return her to the people who she is trying to return to. So he's a nice, neutral guy. But in terms of what you're mentioning to Justin there about what the film might be missing, I think that voice of Native American people is really missing, because it's really at a time where they're being pushed out. He has this child who's being raised in the indigenous community, and it felt like there was an attempt to try and include this into the story, but the Native American indigenous voice were really missing, and that for me was a letdown.
And even though she has been brought up in the Native American community, Justin, this essentially is just another Western with two white protagonists at the centre of it, with Paul Greengrass directing it. Have we moved far from John Ford's The Searchers?
I think it doesn't have the overt racism of the Searchers. It probably is more in common with a movie like Unforgiven, which you know does kind of have that neutral view. There is a kind of a touching scene where there's an interaction with the Kiowa people, but it's not really politicized in any kind of clear way. There's also some very strong racism about, you know, African Americans and their role in Texas, but it's all done a little bit pushed off to the side. It is more like True Grit. It's a girl and an older cowboy, and they're finding their shared humanity.
Does it work overall, and stars from you, Sarah?
I'm saying 3.5 out of 5. I mean, it's nice. I absolutely love the way of reading the news. I would love to get together and shout at some stories. I think it's a really beautiful film. It's worth pointing out, beautiful blues. So the beautifulness of it, you know, the slow unwinding makes it a nice lockdown watch. But, you know, 3.5 only.
3.5 for me. You, clearly you don't have a family like ours that shouts at the news all the time. What about you, Justin?
I'm just a little more generous. I gave it 4 stars, but I think that's exactly it. It's not brilliant. It's just a nice journey to go on.
All right, and available on Netflix, which makes it easy and easy to watch if you happen to have that platform in your home. Let's move on then to music. Somewhat controversial feature film debut from the singer-songwriter Sia, who directed the film, co-wrote it with Dallas Clayton. The film stars Kate Hudson, Leslie Odom Jr., who's garnered plaudits for his performance in Hamilton, and Maddie Ziegler, of Dance Moms and many other Sia videos. She plays the title role of a teenager with autism, a teenager who's referred to as Music. It's a classic kind of initial setup here, Justin.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, the sister who's had a lot of drug issues and is on probation, you know, their grandmother dies and finds out that she's the only family left for her half sister, who is, as you say, non-verbally autistic, and she's going to have to grow up and become the caregiver and be there for Music the way the grandmother was. So yeah, a very traditional kind of setup about, you know, the unexpected, you know, burden of family, I suppose. And so Zoo, who's played by Kate Hudson, tries, you know, initially does her best to try and learn how to deal with Music and get taught how to, you know, to deal with some of her issues. And this is where the controversy starts, when Music has starts to lash out physically. She restrains her physically, which is not the advised, you know, way of dealing with those situations. And that's really where the controversy starts.
Yeah, so that's part of the controversy. But I think another part of the controversy, and it bothered you, Sarah, is the casting of Maddie Ziegler in this role of a teenager with autism.
Yeah, it's just awful. I actually have to say, I hadn't read any of the criticism around it before I watched the film. So I went in with no prejudgment. And there was just this stomach-sinking moment as the film sort of progressed slightly. And I was like, wait a second, this is Maddie Ziegler from Dance Moms. You know, she doesn't typically have an acting background, and as far as I'm aware, has no involvement with people who are autistic. And the film, I believe, did not consult with people who are autistic in the writing, in the casting, in the portrayal. So you start seeing, the Music character, I believe, has some muscular contraction problems, and perhaps even an intellectual disability. So it dawns on you, we're like, is Maddie Ziegler, is she contracting her face? Is she imitating someone with who's non-verbal autistic and has a physical and intellectual disability? And you're like, oh my God, she is the year of our Lord 2020. And she is mimicking with no knowledge this person. And it adds nothing to the story. I was thinking, okay, they're going to, you know, I don't know about this, but they're going to make some excellent point about the life of autistic people who are nonverbal. And then it just goes nowhere and adds nothing to the plot.
Yeah, but what, you recognize her as Maddie Ziegler, but, you know, does it have to be a person with autism? I think it's a good point to say that people with autism were not consulted in the making of the film and in the background. That's a very important detail, I think. But how important is it, Justin, if you don't know that's Maddie Ziegler, if she gives us a believable portrayal, is that not acceptable? That's acting.
You know, it raises a lot of ethical questions about, yeah, who can play who. I think what is really, what really jars, though, because I was the same. I didn't know anything really about the film. I read about all this after I'd watched it. But I had that moment as well, and it's because the first time we meet Music is in this musical dream world that the character lives in. And she's dancing, and none of those physical traits are apparent. None of the facial tics or anything like that are apparent. And then we kind of come out of that Michael Gondry-esque dream world back to, you know, to the reality of Music. And you immediately start going, oh, she's acting. Oh, okay. It's just really jarring. And you start to think about these ethical questions instead of, you know, following the story. But I do agree with you. I mean, I think of Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot, and where are those boundaries? I mean, I do think they're important conversations to have. And certainly, though, of course, he did his research, and it was based on a real person, so there was a lot of material to draw on. Not in this case, I don't think.
Well, let's have a listen to Kate Hudson as Zoo in one of the musical sequences that you're talking about. So the Music character heads into these fantasy worlds and sees all of the other characters, I suppose, where things are working out very well for them. And here's Zoo, the Kate Hudson character. And then
and dollar bills from the bottom of
All right, she's giving it lots of welly. There is Kate Hudson as Zoo in the film, which is called Music. Overall, then, in terms of this film, Sarah, did the it was the Maddie Ziegler character, did that ultimately wreck your enjoyment of the movie, or were there other aspects of it where it did work?
No, is the short answer. So Sia is doing this as a reinvention of the screen musical. What she means by that is that the dialogue and the narrative is going to be interspliced by these music videos, which are set on a lot with brightly coloured and lots of grandiose costumes. What I find most troubling about those musical segments that, you know, are incongruous with the rest of the production is that, you know, it's a bit like Justin was saying there, that we begin and music is in this dream world and she doesn't have the physical disability and she doesn't seem to have her nonverbal autism. So it's almost like that, you know, autistic people are saying, oh yeah, we dream of not having autism, or, you know, in the dream world, we're not like this. And I thought that contrast was really strange, and also that, you know, having these videos interspliced really robbed the film of any emotional gravitas, because it's all a joke, you know, and we're going to go and parade in and start dancing. Aside from that, like, it's terribly written and just mostly boring and strange. Sia inserts herself into this at one point just to add to the egocentrism. You know, she has a strange entry. So a character points out, it's like, oh, is that a Sia wig? So, like, yeah. Honestly, I'm calling this the worst vanity project of the 21st century. It's all about Sia, Sia's worldview, Sia's musical vision, and it just doesn't work.
And how many stars does it get?
I'm going to give it a very charitable 1 star because the music is kind of nice.
The music is kind of nice. I think you're not quite as down on it as that, Justin.
No, I think there was some really good intentions here, and there was a good movie desperately trying to get out of the very confused film that they ended up making. I mean, Kate Hudson is great, especially in the second half of the film. But I generously gave it 3 stars, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone at the same time.
All right, 3, but not recommending it. Nevertheless, okay, that's Music. And Kate Hudson, barely recognisable with her very tight haircut, it has to be said as well. Let us move on then to our final film of the evening, Private Chat, PVT, spelt private there. I hear the sighs and groans already. Maybe, Sarah, you could give us the basic setup here. We're talking about the internet and we're talking about how it might distort our lives and in particular our sex lives.
Yeah, so this is sensibly about a grubby man called Jack. You know, he lives alone in his apartment. He sleeps on a mattress on the floor, but he has this kind of dream-like almost internet persona where he's a talented, he says, blackjack player, which he uses as a source of income. He has an addiction, I believe, to sex workers, and cam girls are his favourite. He uses them for his social interaction. He develops a close bond with Scarlett, who's played by Julia Fox, who people might recognise from Uncut Gems. So he develops a relationship with her. They speak daily, and he gets to, you know, live this fantasy that he's a wealthy tech man. But in reality, he's very little friends. Now, he, in some ways, stalks her, and their relationship intensifies. And yeah,
we're not spared anything, Justin, when it comes to the portrayal of what Jack, who's the character played by Peter Vack. Jack's visiting these chat rooms and specifically speaking to Scarlett, played by Julia Fox. We're not spared any detail on what's happening.
No, we are not spared any detail at all. I mean, with basically the first shot of the film is him online with her, pleasuring himself. And you get the point, and then it continues, and it continues some more, and you wonder when it's going to stop, and it doesn't stop. And that's just kind of the theme of the film, that some of the sexual encounters are just so gratuitous and just seem endlessly long. Like, we got the point's been made, and then we wonder what is going on.
But is that, you know, obviously there was a discomfort for you in watching it. Is that discomfort maybe not part of what the filmmaker was trying to make us feel in the watching of those scenes in particular?
I mean, I do think there was an attempt to make us to share that alienation and share his loneliness and see how he's, you know, dealing with it and with this kind of obsessive sexual compulsion. But it starts to feel like the film has the obsessive sexual compulsion, especially the final scene. I mean, it just made me sad. Like, I didn't feel like I should be there. Like, I felt like I wasn't watching something, you know, some kind of, you know, depiction of sex on film, which is obviously a very big issue right now. It felt like I was intruding on a real sex act in a way that was inappropriate. Like, it just didn't feel like I should be there. I felt sad.
Yeah, exploitation is a big theme, Sarah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the classic thinking would be that, oh yes, the sex worker, Scarlett, you know, is being exploited. But really it shows that the true exploiters of her are her, like, parasitic leech boyfriend who is, you know, funding his poor theatrical efforts from her camming work. And, you know, her need to financially survive is a kind of exploitation. And perhaps even how, you know, internet platforms exploit us. The platform in which Jack uses to speak to Scarlett is heavily gamified, and we're given, and the film itself is gamified in a way that the screen gives us a notification when Jack gives Scarlett money. It gives us a notification when Scarlett's online. It invites us to kind of consider the gamified nature of our life and the hopping from dopamine hit to dopamine hit, and how truly that's isolating us. We have this wonderful internet life, but at that the detriment of our interpersonal reactions and relations.
But let's listen to a scene from Private Chat where, in fact, they're trying to break down that online life, if you like, and to get to know each other as real people. Julia Fox as Scarlett and Peter Vack playing the character of Jack.
Hey, what's up?
Look who it is.
Good to see you again.
I didn't expect you back so soon. I was pretty brutal last time.
What have you been doing since we last spoke?
Nothing much, just abusing slaves like you.
Come on, how much do I have to tip you for you to just, like, drop the act a little bit and just, like, talk to me?
200 tokens.
Okay.
Okay.
Ooh, 200 tokens.
I guess I used to kind of enjoy painting.
Wow, that's awesome.
No, it's not.
Yes, that's amazing. You're an artist. That's the coolest thing I've heard all day.
Well, then your life must be pretty boring.
Julia Fox as Scarlett and Peter Vack as Jack in the scene there from Private Chat. Does it go anywhere then towards humanising the people who are both being exploited and exploiting, Justin?
I don't think so. I mean, I felt like I was participating in the exploitation, you know, by watching the film. And at the very end, I think there's supposed to be, you know, a happy ending with the phone call that resolves some of the issues. But really, you realize the context of that phone call is that Scarlett is going to continue to be exploited to, you know, to fund other things. So it just feels like it's perpetuating a loop and not really offering any solution or insight, you know, that has a value in a humanistic kind of way.
And you weren't too happy, Sarah, with Sia moving from her music world into the world of filmmaking. What about Ben Hosey there from Bodega? He's the writer and director, Ben Hosey from Bodega, the art rock band.
Oh, you know, I'm. He can do it.
Oh, he's allowed, is he?
Just because I say. So I have to say, I love Private Chat. I thought it was it is so weird and it is so uncomfortable. And I think what Justin was saying, scenes drag on and you're like, oh my God. But then it kind of blindsides you. Well, one, it makes you feel claustrophobic and icky in a way that I think is healthy for us to do, to confront how we should be feeling. These interactions go on every day. Maybe, you know, people feel isolated from their real life and are exploited in awful ways. Why not feel uncomfortable about it rather than continuing as normal? Why not examine? Why not enjoy some claustrophobia? And it's not really a happy ending, but I mean, it is an ongoing fact of reality and life. So I kind of enjoyed it.
Which means I think there's going to be a big difference in the star ratings here. You first, Justin.
I love when this happens.
Well, there was a film called Brown Bunny made by Vincent Gallo where the actors had real sex on screen, and it was considered one of the worst films ever made. I think it can step aside for a moment. I gave it a reluctant one. I'm no prude, but it just was too much.
Okay, a reluctant one from Justin and from you, Sarah.
It's a four.
Fabulous.
Yeah, I love the awkwardness. I love the realistic nature. I like that they didn't spare us any detail and we really confronted the whole issue.
All right. Well, great to get a difference of opinion like that. Sarah Taffe-McGuire and Justin McGregor speaking to us about Private Chat, music and news of the world. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. Our Songs, Our Place is a new recording from the Ulster Orchestra. It features 9 songs by local songwriters developed through the guidance of the orchestra and a group of mentors. Songwriters were invited to submit a song that spoke to their life and experience of lockdown. And from 69 entries, 9 were chosen to work with a mentor and the orchestral arranger, Paul Campbell. One of the lucky singer-songwriters was Andrew Farmer, and his mentor was Peter Wilson, known to you and me as Duke Special. They both join me now. Duke, first of all, maybe you tell me, the recording here is called Our Songs, Our Place, but it's developed from a project called the Your Song Now Project. What exactly was involved there?
Yeah, so it was really the brainchild of Paul, who ended up orchestrating everything and conducting, and the Ulster Orchestra. And it was a way, I suppose, just a glimmer of hope in everything, and a way of, being creative and encouraging creativity. So people were, it was like an open call. Anyone could submit a song, and many, many people did. Mm. So the idea was to submit a song that, as you explained, said something about what it felt like at the minute, and there were all kinds of songs submitted, and then Paul, Kit, Philippa, and myself had to go through and kind of make shortlists, our own shortlists, and then battle it out for the final 9 that were then chosen to be orchestrated.
Yeah, so yourself and Kit Philippa, winner of the Northern Ireland Music Award for Best Album in 2020, yourself and Kit were the mentors as such, and Paul was involved as a mentor, obviously, but obviously on the arranging side of things as well. Did you get to choose the songs then that specifically that you mentored?
Yeah, I mean, all of the songs on the final 9. It was a consensus between all 3 of us, and then we had particular songs that we championed. But all of us were absolutely in love with Andrew's song. So I got the lucky straw, I guess, if you want to call it. Mentoring sounds very fancy, but all we did really was have a chat about the song and what way maybe it could be orchestrated, the song was all Andrew, and fantastic. So, yeah.
Well, it'd be interesting to hear if Andrew thought it was just a matter of a little bit of advice from Duke Special. First of all, Andrew, you were a musician, and in fact, you were working on an album when you saw this idea from the Ulster Orchestra looking for songs.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on a record, kind of a not a greatest hits, but a comeback kind of a thing. I've been working on a record for the last number of years, and so yeah, I saw the call out, and I mean, it's like something out of a movie. And I had this one song that I was toying with putting onto the record, and I knew it was sort of special, and I obviously saw the call out and threw my hat in the ring, and it got picked, and it was a once in a lifetime opportunity, you know.
We'll come to the song in a minute, but what's your version of the help that you got from Duke in particular on as a mentor on this song?
Oh yeah, I mean Peter's reputation goes before him. You know, he's got so much experience, and he's done so much for Northern Ireland music, and it was great to kind of get his take. He's obviously worked with orchestras before. And he's toured, and he's played for many years, and I've always been a huge fan of his work. So it was great to get his pick his brains about the song and work on the arrangement and work on the key and just kind of make it ready for an orchestra.
I'm going to listen to the song in a minute, but 2 questions before I do that. What did you write? Did you write the song at the piano, or did you write the song on a guitar?
I wrote the song on a guitar.
So the change to orchestration must have been quite phenomenal. And I'll talk to you about that after we listen to the song itself. But maybe lead me into the kind of ideas you were exploring then. The song is called Paraclete, which is a kind of theological source to it in some ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's this word that I would have heard a lot when I was younger in and around religion. And I guess fundamentally it means spirit. But one of the sort of the my favorite definitions of that word is someone who brings hope. And I love the challenge in that personally about being a person that could bring hope into other people's lives. I guess I've always thought that, you know, my job as a songwriter is sometimes to give people words that they don't have themselves. And that was kind of the premise for the song.
All right. Well, let's listen to it then. It's yourself performing here, Andrew, with the Ulster Orchestra. Paraclete.
Fahrenheit. There's a heaviness about the nature of you.
A song called Paraclete there from a new record from the Ulster Orchestra called Our Songs, Our Place, and it's part of a project called the Your Song Now Project. The performer there and the songwriter, in fact, was Andrew Farmer, and the man who mentored him in translating that song from a piece written at guitar onto that orchestral arrangement that we heard was Duke Special. Andrew, it's a phenomenal song. It really stopped me in my tracks when I was listening to it earlier on, and particularly that line where you talk about the fortitude of the solitude. Did you find some strength then in being alone and locked down?
Yeah, I mean, to me it's as much a prayer as it is a song, and you hear that term, you know, about a month of Sundays, but I guess the pandemic has felt like many months of Sundays. And I don't know about you, but I felt somewhat of a some kind of a slowing down as a response to that. So I guess the song really was my own interpretation of slowing down and the weightiness of the moment that we were in, you know.
Peter, I'm not surprised that you felt you drew the lucky straw when you got that song. It's really powerful, and that orchestral arrangement really brings it out. Andrew, also, it has to be said, has a brilliant voice for the song.
Yeah, no, it was the poetry of the song really grabbed my attention when I first heard it. There were just so many lines that do that really fantastic thing in poetry or good song lyrics, where they give you a sense of something without spelling it out. And that was the first thing. And then I think there was just something about that list of words and of phrases that and just the cyclical kind of chords that really worked for me. So I love the song.
Yeah, not surprised. Before we finish up, Andrew, you the album then, what is the album called, and will Paraclete now be on the album?
Yeah, it's a strange one, because the album was pretty almost finished, and then we decided, because the song was kind of out there in the domain now, we would kind of put it into the album as well. So the album's called Amelanceir, and it's going to be out in May June time under Bluestack Records.
Briefly, what's Amelanceir, that word?
Amelanceir is a tree. It's just one specific tree that kind of does everything. It's got flowers, it's got fruit, it's got colour. It kind of looks good in the winter time. So it's just this all-encompassing tree that everyone should put in their garden.
Clearly sounds like the one to have. And Peter, coming to you then. First of all, a couple of questions I want to ask you. Pat McCabe's Breakfast on Pluto, you were working on a musical version of this. What's happened with that, given the current situation?
Yeah, well, it was almost this time last year when we launched on stage at the Olympia, ahead of its premiere at the Galway Arts Festival, and then it was going to have a run at the Olympia, and then a number of months touring on UK mainland. So, that was all obviously put on hold, and we're still kind of don't know really what's happening, like every other live event or theatre performance. So it'll happen at some point. But yeah, it was very exciting to be involved in that.
I've also been looking at some of the stuff you've been doing online. A gramophone club, which has been described as the Goon Show meets Tom Waits taming lions in a Victorian parlour. Duke Special's Gramophone Club. Is that what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. It's myself and Temperance Society, Chip Bailey, have been hosting it. And it is a collection of songs and guests and playing gramophone records and a lot of silliness. So it's been a lovely way of letting our hair down during the last few months.
Yeah, and one final and very important question. I hadn't seen you in months, and there I saw you. You're talking about letting your hair down. None of that anymore. The dreadlocks are gone.
Yeah. It was time. Just felt wanted to have a change. I'm used to it now, but I still meet people and they kind of wonder who I am. I like it. I like the change.
Well, I was wondering who it was, and then I realised it was you. But anyway, fans will get a nice surprise when they see you next. Listen, thanks to both of you for speaking to us this evening. That's Peter Wilson and Andrew Farmer. And the song that you heard, Paraclete, is part of a recording called Our Songs, Our Place, which is available for purchase digitally from all major online retailers and in CD format from ulsterorchestra.org.uk/ Our Songs, Our Place.
13 minutes to 8. Now, so often we look to literature and song rather than the visual arts when we seek to recall our capital city.
I remember that summer in Dublin, and the liffias, it stank like hell, and the young people walking on Grafton Street, everyone looking so well.
Maybe we're a little white for that kind of thing.
Do you not get it, lads? The Irish are the blacks of Europe, and Dubliners are the blacks of Ireland, and the Northside Dubliners are the blacks of Dublin. So say it once, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud.
Beating through the highs and lows, still the energy lights my soul, but I'm still here despite my woes. You know how it goes, it's the life we chose. You were there from the start, and yeah, it was hard. Dreams are moving on, but it never works when the tear was apart. Summertime and rare form, just another child to...
How is that for the National Press, me brown son? How is that for Martin Murphy, the Bantry jobber?
Ah, well, thanks be to God they had the start of us. Drink that now, citizen.
I will, honourable person.
Health, Joe, and all down the farm.
Ah! Ew! Don't be talking.
I was blue mouldy for the want of that point, and declare to God, I could hear it hit the pit of my stomach with a click.
Don't walk away, don't walk away, don't walk away.
No more hanging on the blocks now. 7 towers is the knockdown. Generation shot down. Some gave up, but others stayed here when they got down. Getting up, getting high, getting down, getting nowhere.
The music of Mango and Mathman and Bagatelle, and the words of James Joyce and Roddy Doyle, literary and musical evocations there of the capital city, Dublin. Now a new book by Catherine Milligan, Painting Dublin 1886 to 1949, looks at a city once the second in the British Empire, cutting its ties with Britain and establishing itself as a republic. Catherine takes this glance through the paintings of the artists who lived in Dublin at that time. I'm delighted to have Catherine Milligan join me now. And there's no doubt, Catherine, really, that there is a rich visual history to Dublin. But has it always played second fiddle? Have the visual arts always played second fiddle, maybe even third fiddle, to literature and music?
Absolutely, Sean. I mean, that's a great introduction that you've given there for kind of the other cultural representations of Dublin. And I suppose it can be maybe sometimes hard for the visual to compete with something that, you know, does have that great kind of voice. But yes, you know, there is such a rich visual history of the city, even dating back to before the 19th century, when we think of, you know, someone like James Malton in the 18th century. And I suppose the visual is always there. It tells us the story of the people who lived in Dublin, a little bit about what the city looked like, how the city changed over time. And I suppose it's finding ways to access these images, to get to see them, and to kind of learn a little bit about the artists who made them is the challenge.
Yeah, I suppose it is a much bigger debate as to why the visual arts should find themselves in that position.
But absolutely.
What you're doing in the book, in some ways, is it an attempt to redress an imbalance that you feel is there?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we do, especially now that Dublin is, it's a UNESCO city of literature, we are so immersed in the literature of it. And I really think that these artists, the six artists that I look at in the book, they deserve to be as well known as any of the writers of the city. And I mean, there are huge overlaps with them. Often they're friends with these writers. They're going to the same theatres and bars. So it's just bringing our kind of awareness back to this visual tradition in the city as well.
Yes, and what you do in the book is that you focus on six artists living in the city through the late 19th and into the 20th century. Some of them big names that we would know, Jack B. Yeats, Walter Osborne, names like that. But since you've mentioned attachments and associations with the literary side of the city, let's go artists from a Jewish background. Harry Kernoff, first of all.
Yes, so
he had huge associations with the literary world.
Absolutely. So he's, you know, very good friends with Patrick Kavanagh. They go on a cycling holiday together. He's really drawn to the Grand Canal, like Kavanagh. But then he's also very much immersed in the world of Dublin's kind of literary pubs, you know, something we're all missing at the moment, but the likes of Davy Burns and the Palace. And so he is, you know, moving in the same circles. And he's painting a really interesting different, you know, sides of the city, whether it's kind of industrial Dublin, kind of the workers of Dublin, labour conditions, but then also just these really evocative kind of scenes of sunny days in Dublin, of sitting by the banks of the Grand Canal, maybe taking a few minutes, taking a bit of time. But also then streets that look completely different now. For example, Wine Tavern Street.
Just as you mentioned Wine Tavern Street there, we're going to tweet the images that you're speaking about as you're telling us about them, Catherine. So let me just remind people that the Twitter handle is at RTE Arena. And if you're on there right now, you'll see that the Wine Tavern Street, a painting from Harry Kernoff that we're speaking about. So maybe just describe that painting to us, if you would, Catherine, and how specifically this shows the Dublin of the day.
The Dublin of the day. So this is a painting that's in the Hugh Lane collection, and it's a really sunny view of the kind of looking down towards the river from Wine Tavern Street. So kind of near Christchurch Cathedral, looking down with an old row of houses there, which aren't there in that state anymore, but were made up of shops and housing. And he's showing us people at work, for example, pushing their trolleys of fruit and produce, maybe up from the market in Smithfield up to kind of other parts of the city. People just going about their day, maybe out for their groceries, walking down, you know, for a bit of relief and just for a bit of fresh air. But it's one of those paintings that really captures this like gentle, I suppose, quietness of Dublin on a summer's day, that is really, really evocative of you know, that time.
Of that period. And not surprising, I suppose, that we would get images of workers from Kernoff and images of businesses there as well. He had a very, very strong socialist background, or certainly socialist bent within him.
Absolutely. So he's very involved in kind of the socialist, kind of communist circles in Dublin through the 1920s and 1930s. In the 20s, that really manifests itself through his kind of involvement with theatre, with cabarets, with nightclubs. And then actually in 1930, he goes to Russia, to the USSR, with the Irish Friends of Soviet Russia. He travels around kind of theatres there, sees how artists are working there. So it was a cause that he was really committed to, especially in that part of his life.
Let's tweet up another image from Kernoff at this point. And this is a bench on Bagot Street at RTE Arena. If you want to look at these images as we're speaking about them, Catherine Milligan, who's with me, talking about her book Painting Dublin 1886 to 1949, and perhaps some of the lesser known names from that period. So describe what we're looking at here.
So this is a view again along the Grand Canal. And it's a view that I suppose are part of the city that we immediately associate with Kavanagh, who was obviously writing about it a little bit later than Kernoff was painting it. But this stretch, Kernoff lived in Portobello, and this stretch of the canal from kind of Portobello down to Grand Canal Dock was an area that he came to again and again. He was walking down it most days, meeting people along that part. And of course, kind of towards the end of the 1940s into the 1950s, you have Parsons Bookshop along there. But again, like the Wine Tavern Street image, this is one of those really contemplative and quiet scenes of Dublin. And I suppose it's a really nice reminder that, you know, when we think of the city, you think of something quite frenetic and busy. But Dublin has all of these wonderful spaces where you can kind of relax, you know, as we have all have come to learn in the over the last few months.
Yeah, and I suppose you mentioned there the fact that it's up in and around Portobello, an area in Dublin often referred to at that time, particularly as Little Jerusalem. A lot of the Jewish community living in and around that area. Kernoff has really given us, if you like, the visual equivalent of Leopold Bloom in some ways here.
There is definitely a parallel to be drawn between them, in that sense of someone who's constantly walking and wandering in the city, who's noticing, you know, the small details, whether it's of advertisements or the groups or people that he sees. Of course, and we don't have an image of it, but you'll find it online, is that Kernoff does paint Davy Byrne's pub, a beautiful view of Davy Byrne's pub that's in the National Gallery. And of course, that's where Bloom goes for his glass of wine and his gorgonzola sandwich. So yes, there is a really interesting parallel to be made between the two men.
All right, let's move on then to Estella Solomons. And incidentally, coincidentally, she is also from a Jewish background, but maybe at a different part of society from Kernoff.
Yeah, so the Kernoff family arrived in Dublin in 1914, but actually the Solomons family are much more established in the city, much more kind of middle class, well set up family living on Waterloo Road. And really, again, interesting, kind of involved in kind of medical circles, the kind of the middle class professional circles, which is very different to Kernoff.
But maybe the first image that we're going to put up here is an image called Carlisle Court from Solomons. This comes from a book that sounds as if it's going to be very beautiful, in fact, but there's quite a gritty realism, I think, within this kind of, or a darkness certainly within these drawings from Solomons.
Yeah, so this is a book. The book came out in several editions between 1918 and 1928, and it was called The Glamour of Dublin. And it does kind of set you up for this, you know, this wonderful kind of 1920s tour of Dublin, whereas really that's not what it is. But it's a book, it's a guidebook written by a man called Daniel Kelleher, who, like Solomons, was kind of very much involved in the literary revival and those kind of circles. But he's giving vignettes of life in the city. And Solomons contributes 8 etchings, actually, to the book. And one of them is this image of Carlisle Court. Now, there would definitely be a prize for anyone who knows where Carlisle Court was. It was one of these kind of small nooks and crannies between different streets in Dublin. So Carlisle Court was between Hawkins Street and Delir Street, near the Leinster Market, which you can still see part of today. And she does give, you know, I think what this image really reminds us of, and what Solomons was drawn to, were these spaces where people were living in very poor living conditions, kind of eking out a life in these narrow, dark, run-down spaces.
And briefly and finally, you might describe the key from us from the south wall, another of Solomon's etchings.
Yes, yeah, so quite a different view, this a view across the city quay from, you know, in or around the Custom House. And she's showing us the river and the boats and the activity on the river. So again, this, you know, showing us the sense of the port and things moving, and the kind of hinting at the kind of trade that was going on in Dublin as well.
Well, that's just a dip into some of the fascinating paintings and thoughts that you give us in the book. That's Catherine Milligan, and the new book is called Painting Dublin, 1886 to 1949. And before we finish up this evening, I wanted to mention Emma O'Kane. Tributes have been paid to the dance artist and choreographer. She died yesterday at the age of 44 following a short illness. Very much associated with Cuishkim Dance Theatre, but indeed very at the centre of Irish dance, the Irish dance world, the Abbey, the Project Art Centre. She was an artist member there. She also worked with Rough Magic, Fish Amble and Anu across a diverse array of projects. I suppose if we look at what Cuishkim said, that says it all for us. Words cannot express our sorrow at the passing of Emma O'Kane. Her artistry, integrity and passion are part of the very fabric of who we are. Our thoughts are with her mum, Joy, family and friends.
The light is dimmer on our stages and the sky shines brighter with its latest star. And so say we here on Arena as well. And you can see some of Emma's work on rte.ie/culture. That is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy were the researchers. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.